From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, December 29th, 2016. And on this day, Maine's U.S. senators take on the potential Donald Trump cabinet. And what's on your New Year's Eve menu? How about salty scarabs or crunchy cockroaches? That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
Longtime Maine newspaperman M.D. Harmon has died after a shooting accident yesterday. Harmon was a staunch conservative. He worked as a reporter, editor, and columnist at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram for more than 40 years. Fred Bever has details.
Throughout his career, Harmon defended conservative points of view pretty much across the board.
On a scale of 1 to 10, he was a number 10 conservative on military issues. He was a number 10 conservative on economic issues. He was a number 10 conservative on social issues. You know, he just hit the mark on all three.
Greg Kesich is the editor of the Press Herald's editorial pages. He says Harmon could be counted on to defend gun rights, condemn abortion, and oppose same-sex marriage. And as a comparative liberal, Kesich says when he joined the editorial team a decade ago, he expected to be in frequent conflict with Harmon.
But I wasn't, because he was a tremendous person to work with. He was very kind. He's incredibly professional. He had some skills, some old newspaper skills that you just don't see anymore. He could proof a page faster than anybody and just find all the typos. He was a very meticulous editor.
Police say Harmon was at his Sanford home showing a teenage boy a handgun when the weapon accidentally discharged. His wife, Margaret Harmon, told the Press Herald the shooting was an accidental tragedy. Police say their investigation is continuing and that those involved are cooperating. Harmon's conservatism had a religious component. This year, he was ordained as a priest in the Charismatic Episcopal Church, a right-leaning offshoot of the Episcopal Church. David Newton is a friend and deacon at the Prince of Peace Church in Sanford, where both men worshipped. Newton says Harmon frequently preached the pro-life message and that outside of the church, he sought to engage in people's lives.
Saturday mornings when there's a farmer's market in Sanford, he would actually take two lawn chairs, go sit there in his clerical uniform with a sign that says Father Michael will listen for free, and had people coming up and talking to him about what was going on in their lives. Was trying to reach out to people that way.
Harmon graduated from high school in Pennsylvania and then came to college at Bowdoin in Maine, where he graduated cum laude. He served in the Army and Army Reserves for 7 years, including two spent in Vietnam. He worked full-time for the Press Herald for 41 years, retiring in 2011. His weekly column continued, though. In this week's salvo, he condemns President Obama's policy on Israel and predicts hard times ahead for the Democratic Party. Harmon is survived by his wife, three children, and two stepchildren. He was 71 years old. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
President-elect Donald Trump cannot formally nominate anyone for cabinet positions or other federal posts until after he's inaugurated on January 20th, but the list of his intended choices grows on an almost daily basis. Mal Leary reports that Maine's two senators are taking a wait-and-see attitude on most of the nominees.
The actual confirmation process will not get underway until late January. And if history is any indication, it will not be a quick process. The Senate committees that have jurisdiction over a particular nominee will hold hearings, but how many hearings and over how long a time are questions that are often not addressed until the process starts.
It's really hard to predict prior to the hearings.
Maine's senior senator, Susan Collins, a Republican, has witnessed and taken part in a lot of confirmation hearings since she was first elected in 1996.
You just never know what the explanations are going to be for certain positions that have been taken, what an individual's background is, how they may respond to questions.
And don't expect Collins to give any immediate indications about how she will vote on a nominee even after the hearing process is underway. In fact, she says it's possible she won't decide on a particular nominee until she's on the Senate floor.
I've always found it wise, unless I know the nominee very well, to withhold judgment until after the hearings are done.
There have been several national news stories suggesting that Collins may be one of the Republicans that could buck Trump's choices. Collins says she will weigh the nominee's abilities and qualifications in the same way that she has done for presidents of both parties over the years. Maine Senator Angus King, an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, says he too will spend a lot of time weighing each nominee.
What I plan to do is go to the hearings of virtually all of the nominees, even though I'm not on the committee. Sit in the audience and listen along with everyone else and try to get a feel for what their views are of all these nominees.
But King acknowledges that he will likely scrutinize some of Trump's choices more closely than others because of the positions they've taken in the past. One nominee, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, has in the past called for doing away with the Energy Department that Trump has asked him to now head. And then there's the case of Kansas Attorney General Scott Pruitt, named by Trump as his pick to run the EPA, who has repeatedly sued that very same agency.
I'm going to go in with an open mind, but on some of them where the fellow has sued the agency that he's being asked to run, I'm going to have a little skepticism.
The incoming administration will have to win Senate confirmation of nearly 700 top federal posts and fill more than 4,000 positions across all areas of government. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
What kind of snacks are you planning to pass around at your New Year's Eve party? Tortilla chips or roasted nuts? How about salty scarabs or crunchy cockroaches? While they are savored elsewhere in the world, insects have not really caught on as a food in most of North America, but that could be changing. With growing concerns over climate change, some experts say it is only a matter of time before we invite our six-legged friends onto the dinner table. And as Jennifer Mitchell reports, one family in Maine is taking that message to heart and getting ahead of the trend with a fledgling entomophagy business and bug farm.
13-year-old Julia Broadbent's snacks are a little different from what most other kids get.
So what is that you guys are about to eat?
Barbecue mealworms, and this is Katie's first time, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Julia's friend Caitlin Sawicki is visiting. She's already tried some of the crunchy crickets the Broadbent family sells, dried and ready to eat from their home business, but this is her first time having a mealworm snack.
They taste pretty good. It's kind of like similar to chips, but they're not as, like, crunchy.
Kind of like a Rice Krispie.
Yeah.
That's Susan Broadbent in the background. She's Julia's aunt and co-owns Ento Market in Auburn, along with her brother, Bill Broadbent. The pair launched the business a little over a year ago, and as far as they know, it's the first marketplace in North America exclusively devoted to edible insects, something they hope will take off.
Just like everybody has a favorite candy bar, everybody has a favorite flavor of ice cream, favorite, you know, snack, everybody will have their own favorite bug, and they'll be like, I love water scorpions, or, you know, or I love fried chrysalis or something like that.
The Broadbents procure both domestic and exotic species wholesale and also grow some of their own crickets, cockroaches, and mealworms upstairs. But space limitation has kept the operation quite small. In the coming months, they're hoping to expand into bigger quarters and offer more bugs. And so far, it's promising. They say the Christmas holiday all but cleaned out their stock.
This has been our full-time job for a year and a half, and this is all we do. We started from absolutely nothing, just an idea.
And that idea came from Bill's son, Sam, now 15.
I asked why we don't eat bugs when I was 13, maybe, or 12. And we researched it, and there wasn't really any reason why not to. So
in other words, he asked me, I gave him a dad answer, and he kept researching it.
What was the dad answer you gave him?
Some people do eat bugs. It's just North America and Europe that don't.
And in that, the broadbent saw an opportunity. Worldwide observers say Western attitudes toward insects may need to change. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, in a 2013 report, concluded that to meet the nutritional requirements of a world that will have swollen to 9 billion people over the next 30 years, the harvesting and cultivation of insects should be explored. David Gracer, a writer and naturalist in Providence, Rhode Island, who's been researching the topic for almost two decades, says with concerns over climate as well as water and land resources and nutritional needs, it's not really a matter of if, but when insects will be coming to a kitchen table near you.
When we see the collision of all of these factors going forward, we see that insects are pretty much the single best option for producing massive amounts of good nutrition in urban environments, because you can farm insects in cities, unlike the bony vertebrate animals.
That one factor alone, he says, could be a huge step toward food security for millions who can't grow their own food due to space constraints. And he recommends that gardeners get in on the fun, too, eating some of the edible pests that plague their crops. Those annoying little green cabbage worms, for example, are perfectly edible, he says, and taste just like the plants they're attacking. And there are other environmental considerations that can be used to make the case for eating insects. One study from 2012 published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE says that the carbon footprint of mealworms is about 10 times less per kilogram of edible protein than beef. Many insects can also be raised on compostable biowaste, getting rid of another source of greenhouse gases, and they need no additional water. By comparison, it takes some 1,800 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. The ideas being proposed are not exactly new. Aside from the millions of people across Africa, Asia, Australia, and South America chowing down on mopani worms, stink bugs, and witchetty grubs, as early as 1885, a book published in England by one Vincent M. Holt posed the question in its title, "Why Not Eat Insects?" The biggest hurdle in that volume, as now, is something the Broadbents call the ick factor. Bill Broadbent says for the new insect eater, starting with crickets ground up in a protein shake is a good way to go.
We joke that it's the gateway bug. It's the bug that everybody's interested in at the moment. It has a lot of protein, has a lot of vitamins and minerals, but there's thousands of bugs. There's a couple thousand bugs that are readily identified as edible. And so we don't even know where it's going yet.
But there are bugs to be worked out as well. The Broadbents lost a large batch of crickets recently because the habitat became too dry, and they had to figure things out on their own. After all, the local cooperative extension agent isn't going to be much help to an insect farmer, but that too will change if the demand is there, say the Broadbents, and they may be on to something. In October, the CEO of Pepsi, Indra Nooyi, announced her prediction for what the next big snack food revolution would be in America. Crickets. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
And that's This Day in Maine, Thursday, December 29th, 2016. Thank you to Ed Morin and to our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.